From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
That's something many couples promise each other on their wedding day when everything looks rather rosy.
Jeff and I were in love, and I was married for love.
So caring and funny.
In health is easy, but the in sickness part can be incredibly challenging.
Just like, what do you do next? What's going to happen next?
65 million Americans care for an ill or elderly loved one. On today's show, we'll take a look at the challenges and what can help them.
Ask the person what you can do for them today. Don't say, let me know when you can use some help. That is worthless.
Also on the show, how smoking pot affects your brain, the changing nature of frog calls, and listen up, oh bearded dude, serious science on the attractiveness of facial hair. First, the news. Big Pharma has to reinvent itself. What's the thinking?
Multi-channel access.
Channels as a strategy, channel as a tactic, and then the talk about the digital ecosystem.
I guess improved outcomes, patient centricity. So it's making sure that your entire organization is focused on the patient.
There's an idea. It's The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse takes you down bumpy roads and follows people right into the doctor's office and science lab to understand the latest research.
It wouldn't shock me if we hit 90 in April.
And we just kind of sat there for a couple seconds in silence, taking this in. Like,
I thought, there has to be a better way to do this. You know, do this, all of this.
The only data that was with the specimen was Cretaceous of New Jersey.
I call it one of the final frontiers in body odor analysis.
It is absolutely like playing Tetris.
Recognizing that the virus needed this.
These rumors were spread.
All required a relationship.
Hey, how are you? Sorry, I'm running behind schedule.
On today's show, 65 million Americans care for a loved one who is ill or elderly. We'll take an intimate look at their lives. Also, using storytelling to get doctors to remember important guidelines. And a second life for chicken feathers. But first up, the pharmaceutical industry is facing an existential moment of sorts. This week, the Eye for Pharma conference was in Philly, drawing a few hundred mid-level executives. Reporter Zach Seward was there. He says the general vibe was drab and buttoned up, but he did get a sense of how Big Pharma wants to see itself. One of the pharma buzzwords of the moment, patient centricity, which means thinking about improved patient health outcomes instead of just the next pill to hit the market. Here's Zach with more.
Big Pharma is at a crossroads. The companies tend to be guarded with the media, even voicing outright disdain at one panel. So I pulled aside Soren Matke for a few questions. He's a scientist at the nonprofit research firm RAND Corporation, who's leading a conference track here about how pharmaceutical companies can identify value beyond the pill.
They know that their traditional business model is under pressure, and they know that they need to evolve. And at the same time, we know that healthcare per se isn't really particularly well organized and delivered.
What Matke is saying is that the last 10 years or so have not been kind to large pharmaceutical companies, and they're starting to feel out some new opportunities across the healthcare landscape in place of what worked before.
The initial blockbuster model was you made a drug that cost about $100 and sold it to a million patients.
Think Lipitor, Singulair, the stuff for common conditions, the stuff with the hushed side effects at the end of the commercial. Those profit-soaked glory days of branded blockbuster drugs are coming to a close because their patents have fallen off the patent cliff. Generics have caught up in potency, and consumers are more skeptical. So now what?
So companies now look at targeted drugs, and those are drugs that cost more like $100,000 and are applied to maybe 1,000 patients.
See what he did there? That's an inversion of the blockbuster model to the point where now a remarkable new hepatitis C drug costs literally $1,000 a pill.
And that is currently their business model, and that's currently sustaining their profits. But in the long run, that is not sustainable.
Because the big payers, insurance companies, Medicare, are likely to say enough is enough. Which gets us back to our crossroads and our new buzzword,
The common theme is everything should be patient-centric.
That's Eva Mitchell of the Bucks County-based Ashfield Healthcare, which pharma companies outsource work to. And here's her take on patient centricity.
Everything that pharmaceutical companies do, from clinical development to getting a product on the market to working with insurance companies and the government, it shouldn't be about the profits. It should be all about better patient care.
I'm hearing way too much about patient centricity. Nobody really knows what that is.
Soren Madke of RAND again.
I generally dislike buzzwords. I think they're mostly created by vendors and consultants, and then they're slapped onto everything.
There's a lot of vendors and consultants here.
Yeah, it's a pharma conference, and there's still money to be made, so I'm not surprised.
But Madke says patient centricity isn't really a bad thing. It means pharma companies are taking to heart consumer needs. Changing business realities are forcing them to rethink who they're actually serving.
I mean, in the past, it was basically the physician was the client. So all communication, all material, all marketing was directed towards the physician. And then there was just the expectation that people would take their pills as prescribed. I think now companies are waking up to the fact that the actual client is the patient.
That means more thought devoted to helping patients on the journey that life-altering diseases can represent. It could mean services, mobile apps, YouTube commercials directly or indirectly related to a company's medicines. Whether that means patients like you and me want that thought lavished on us, that's for another conference. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
We've been seeing a lot of pictures of happy people buying marijuana in smoke shops across Colorado. The state has a new law legalizing the sale of pot for recreational use. Washington State will soon follow suit, and other states are smelling the potential for big revenues. But what do we know about marijuana's impact on our brains? Mary Cummings Jordan has this story.
These days, a person can walk into a specialty shop in Colorado, buy a small amount of marijuana to use as he or she chooses, and walk out without fear of prosecution. Similar stores will soon be open for business in Washington State, and now lawmakers in the Delaware Valley are watching with interest. Colorado stands to reap millions in tax revenue from the sale of pot, and this has caught the attention of New Jersey State Senator Nicholas Scutari. He's introduced a bill to legalize.
So we're talking in New Jersey, just sales and tax revenues of hundreds of millions of dollars for New Jersey. That's not to mention the secondary effects of having fuller employment, of having people in sales and farming jobs and contracting jobs that would go along with it.
Discussions about legalizing marijuana are usually highly charged, but what do we really know about the long-term effects of using marijuana, for example, on the brain? Marijuana for recreational use is illegal on the federal level, so research has been slim compared to that involving alcohol. But in looking at the studies that have been done, here's what scientists know so far. Marijuana can be detrimental to teens and young adults in particular. Dr. Crystal Lisdahl is assistant professor of neuropsychology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She says during the teenage years and into the early 20s, the brain is still developing.
So there's this pruning going on of the gray matter, which includes the neurons, where inefficient connections are being eliminated and the brain is getting more specialized. At the same time, we see an increase in white matter, and that's the fatty lining of the axons of the neurons. And basically, with those two things together, we see that the adolescent and emerging adult brain becomes more adult-like, becomes more specialized, becomes faster, and is more efficient. Using marijuana regularly during this period, so that means at least a couple times a week all the way to daily, may actually disrupt this neurodevelopment. So we see alterations in the gray matter, so those neurons, and we also see reduced white matter integrity.
Bad news, according to Tom McClellan, head of the Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia.
It affects motivation, cognition, the ability to inhibit, and the ability to concentrate, functions that are really useful in school and work and other areas.
Even though marijuana would not legally be sold to anyone under 21, researchers say most people start to experiment in their teens. And McClellan says if an adult buys it, young people will find it.
My best examples to corroborate that would be alcohol. That's where kids get a lot of the alcohol that they use, and most recently, prescription opioids.
Scientists say marijuana can be addictive and that long-term use can lead to intellectual damage. Dr. Lisdahl points to a general health study conducted in New Zealand over an 18-year period, which also examined frequent marijuana use.
If you started regularly before age 18, when they were 38, they had an 8-point IQ loss.
That's the thing that keeps you out of college. That's the kind of thing that will keep you from getting a pilot's license. It's not trivial.
So if you're a regular user and you decide to stop, can the brain recover? Dr. Lisdahl says researchers are trying to determine whether sustained abstinence can improve brain function to baseline levels. However, progress can take a while.
Even after 30 days of abstinence, adolescent and young adult marijuana users have a hard time sustaining their attention over time, take more time on complex cognitive tasks. They have poor impulse control, poor decision making, and overall they have trouble learning new material.
Marijuana contains tetrahydrocannabinol, which attaches to receptors in the brain, helping to produce the feelings of relaxation and even euphoria users seek. Today's pot is a lot more potent than it was back in the day. Lisdahl says the THC content is 15 to 20% as opposed to 4% 20 years ago.
Makers have actually genetically engineered the plant to have higher THC content. So users smoking the pot experience a bigger high and more euphoria. The problem is that it also comes with greater side effects like anxiety, panic, and paranoia.
Tom McClellan is concerned this much stronger version will be heavily marketed toward teenagers. Dr. Lisdahl says it's already happening in Colorado.
Marijuana pops, marijuana brownies, and if you look at the packaging, they're clearly not marketing these to 40-year-olds, right? I mean, this is very youthful marketing.
So is marijuana use safe for anyone? There is some agreement in the scientific world that adults who are over 25 and do not suffer mental health issues can probably indulge occasionally and not see long-term changes in the brain. As far as legalizing is concerned, McClellan wants Jersey to wait.
I would say to the state of New Jersey, what is your hurry? You have two really informative, important experiments going on out there in Washington State and in Colorado. Monitor what's going on. See what the true tax dollars are that come in. Don't rush into this because don't think it's a free payday or it's a gold mine. It's certainly not.
As the nation watches the marijuana experiment unfold, the debate is certain to continue. Now that legalization is in the public spotlight, there is a considerable amount of new research being conducted into marijuana's effect on the brain, aided by technology far superior to that of even 10 years ago, technology which Dr. Lisdahl says can allow scientists to look much more closely at gray matter, white matter, chemical signaling, and brain function. For The Pulse, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan.
Senator Scutari's bill to legalize marijuana for recreational use in New Jersey is currently before the state Senate Judiciary Committee. Starting next week, some serious scientific questions will come under consideration in Philadelphia.
How many rubber bands does it take to explode a watermelon? Why are Philadelphians so intense about sports? Is there a cure for a hangover?
That's because Philadelphia Science Festival kicks off next Friday. The festival is in its fourth year and features hundreds of talks and experiments all around the city. So, what to pick? What to do? Pulse reporter Alana Gordon grilled the Franklin Institute's Jerry Truskin, the main organizer, with seven questions.
Okay, Jerry, what event do you think is most likely to gross out visitors?
We have an event called Ick this year. It's really designed to gross out our visitors. It's called Creatures That Make Your Skin Crawl. And we're looking at gross things that are actually, you know, a little bit misunderstood. So everything from pond scum to roaches and the scientists who love them.
What's the best event to bring a first date?
So this could go either way. It could go either really great or it could be a bad first date too. Is Love, Lust, and Loathing. We have six speakers. three of which are going to talk about love, lust, and loathing in humans, and three who are going to explore that in animals. So if love and lust are what comes out of it, and then great first date. If loathing is what you end up being more excited about, maybe not the best first date.
What activity would you bring kids to?
If I had to choose one, I think Mess Fest at Smith Playground is something that every kid should be really excited about. Smith Playground is a historic playground in Fairmount Park, and we're going to be doing tons of messy explosions. We're going to have an oobleck, which is this, it's cornstarch and water. It's, can't tell if it's a solid or a liquid, and it'll be an oobleck dance party.
Sounds messy.
It is, yes, definitely very messy.
Who is Dr. Skateboard?
Dr. Skateboard looks at the physics of skateboarding, and he's going to be at a number of our events. We're having a science of skateboarding program at Paines Park, right on the river.
What's the one event you think will be most talked about?
We're doing an event which is sort of unique to Philadelphia called Fanatics. So Philadelphia's love-hate relationship with sports. And, it really is getting into the science of fanaticism and groupthink and what is the neuroscience and the psychological, psychosocial reason for crazy fandom. And Philadelphians are really into being fans.
What sort of real-life skills can someone get from the science festival?
We actually have an event that's all about how you can use math to help you win. So anything from fantasy football to Scrabble to the Monty Hall problem, which is, there are three doors. How do you choose the one that has the car behind it and using statistics?
What event is most likely to blow the mind of returning visitors?
So at the close of the Science Carnival on the Parkway on May 3rd, at the very end of the festival, we're doing a giant launch of Alka rockets. So it's Alka-Seltzer and water in a film canister. And we're doing 5,000 of those at the end of the festival. So we'll flip two big tables over, and it will be an enormous explosion. And it will definitely blow the minds of anybody who's there.
Jerry Chuskin, thanks for joining The Pulse.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is one thing you listeners might want to take note of about next week's festival. It is not to be confused with a science fair.
It's funny because when people ask, they'll be like, oh, how's the science fair planning going? And I'm like, it's a festival!
Fairs are for kids to show off their science projects.
No disrespect to a science fair, because science fairs are important and wonderful.
But Truskin says science festivals, those are for everyone. Kids, regular folks, scientists, to come together, get nerdy, and celebrate science across the city. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You can find out more details about the festival on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Oh, and the music you're hearing, that's composed from Game Boys by the artist Shippocrit, who's performing at the festival. Coming up on The Pulse, a happy marriage, children, a good life. Then illness changes everything.
There are times I never do this, but inside I'm going, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up.
The challenges of caring for a sick family member and the rewards. That's next on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Every year, 65 million Americans provide care for a loved one, an ill spouse, an elderly parent, a child, a friend. They spend about 20 hours a week doing this, and they are unpaid. They are, in a way, a huge but hidden part of the healthcare sector.
There isn't a single person listening to this show who, in some way, is either not a caregiver, then a caregiver, will be a caregiver.
Quoting that number, 65 million Americans, doesn't tell you all that much. What's it like to be a caregiver? We're going to hear two stories, two perspectives on caring for a loved one, and then we'll talk with somebody who's walked that road and wants to prevent caregivers from burning out.
Our lives felt a little bit like war.
That's how mathematician Marion Deutsch Cohen describes the period in her life when she cared for her husband, Jeff, who had MS.
Well, spouses, I was a well spouse. The spouse is somebody who's not well, who's chronically not well, often talk about other people who are not well spouses being civilians. You know, they talk about it jokingly, and it does kind of feel that way.
Her existence came down to three words.
Nights, lifting, and toilet. Nights means waking up. It wound up being every 15 minutes or so from his various needs. Lifting, well, he weighed more than I did. I was lifting him from the wheelchair to the, because he was almost completely paralyzed, from the wheelchair to, in particular, the toilet. Sometimes he would slip, and then I would be lifting him off the floor.
Deutsch Cohen's husband, Jeff, was in his 30s when he was diagnosed. His condition started to deteriorate rapidly in his 40s. Two of their four children were still small, and the challenges started to wear Marion down.
I broke my ankle, probably because I was tired. The day after, our home health aide called and said he couldn't show that day. So there I was with a broken ankle, and Jeff just stayed in bed that day.
Deutsch Cohen has written two books about her experience, one called Dirty Details, which talks about home caregiving, and Still the End, which describes the years her husband spent in a nursing home and his eventual death. She says writing the books helped her process a roller coaster of emotions that she experienced as a caregiver. She also says she doesn't want to lose the memories of the many happy times she had with her husband.
Happy birthday to you.
Diane Fayon of Bryn Athyn had plenty of those happy memories. She and her husband Bill were high school sweethearts.
I actually knew of him. He was on the football team. This sounds like so all-American. I was a cheerleader. Ah, he was just so caring and funny and cute. He had the nickname Sugar Bear.
Home movies tell a story of a great life raising five sons.
And there's Bill.
Okay, ready to sing.
That's a pretty nice fish, Aaron. Tell us how you caught him.
But about 9 years ago, Diane Fayon noticed that her husband Bill was changing.
Every time he saw a dog, he was just like a little kid with the dog. He was so excited, overly excited for a man in his mid-50s.
Their son Jason noticed the changes too.
We were hanging drywall, and I hadn't really done much hanging of drywall. So I asked him, how do you hang drywall? And he said, I don't know. And I was like, Dad, you'd put drywall in our entire house.
After a series of doctor's visits, Bill was finally diagnosed with something called frontotemporal degeneration. It's a devastating brain disorder that causes the front part of the brain to atrophy. That means compulsive behavior, a lack of empathy, a lack of short-term memory. There's no cure. The disease just gets progressively worse. Here's Bill Fayon telling and retelling a joke, something he does very often.
What time is it when an elephant sits on a fence? Time to get a new fence. What's the difference between an elephant and a flea? An elephant can have fleas, but a flea cannot have elephants. What time is it when an elephant sits on a fence?
There are times I never do this, but inside I'm going, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. And sometimes when I just am at my limit, I'll say, Bill, I'm not doing well. You really need to go away? No, I can't answer any more questions. You just need to give me some space. And he will.
Small tasks have become big challenges. Here's some audio Diane Fayon recorded when she and Bill made his favorite salad dressing.
All right, so we need to measure 1.5 cups honey.
Into what? Where's the honey?
Yes, which one is the honey?
The one that says honey is going to be the honey.
So can you find the honey looking at it?
Nope.
So how are you finding the honey?
Looking for a container that has honey written on the on it. Nothing says honey. Nope. There isn't any honey here.
Okay, this says...
Oh, it says pure honey.
Diane Fayon says she misses having a partner, sharing things. Here's some more audio she recorded in their home.
It's been kind of a hard day. I have a pain in my rib that I am very concerned about. And I just told Bill about it. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry. That happens sometimes. And then he started talking about my mother. He is now smiling at me. Do you want to say something?
Hello, hello. You're so beautiful and sweet.
It went from a partnership to me handling absolutely everything. It was like being in a ditch that has muddy walls, and I have to claw my way out and carry him up on my back. That's what it felt like. I started going to counseling, and there's a support group. I signed up for an exercise class with a physical trainer. Well, I got a cat. Part of clawing my way out was accepting that our marriage was over in one sense, that we had to have a different relationship. So where I am now is I've come to accept it. I wouldn't say embrace it, but certainly accept it.
WHYY's Carolyn Beeler originally reported this story in 2012. Since then, Bill Fayon's condition has rapidly deteriorated. He is still at home, but now has to have a caregiver with him at all times. And his wife, Diane, says she now notices new changes every week. Diane Fayon just spoke about coming to terms with her situation, and that's a big theme for author Yosef August, who wants to help caregivers keep their sanity.
Wherever you are is where you are, and accept that and honor that. Wherever it is, whatever is going on for you, whatever you're feeling about it, honor that.
August has written a book called Coaching for Caregivers. He says burnout is a major issue because people don't pay attention to their own health. That happened to him when he cared for his father.
I got shingles. I was walking in the hallway of my father's hospice in Florida, and I asked his doctor to take a look at my back, and he looked and he says, "You have shingles." And I did the eulogy for my dad, but bent over in pain from shingles.
August encourages caregivers not to neglect their feelings and their well-being.
There's not a lot of permission, you know, there's not a lot of acceptance for admitting what a tough time you're having. And the fact that you can't complete a task you're working on because your loved one needs something else right now, and then something else right now, and all those things as they build up. And for a lot of people, unless they reach out for support, which I am an advocate of, they just stuff those feelings and they feel shame about them. I shouldn't be feeling so resentful.
How do you start to take care of yourself?
Find something that you can do today that only takes 5 minutes. If you want to take a little longer, 10 minutes, and then maybe you could take a bath. There are some resources that are available that were not available when I was a caregiver for my parents and my mother-in-law. And I call these care sites. They're free websites, and you wind up not having to return phone calls and emails and that kind of thing. You can just simply put out your message. And then there's a calendar. And you just say, I need my lawn mowed. I need a meal delivered on Friday afternoon. I need the cleaning picked up. And start to let people in and to share the care. And how to set your boundaries. My friend Betsy emailed me late one night and said that her husband Mel was fading. He was going real fast and he was living in California. And I booked a flight to California. She emailed me later that night saying, please don't come. At night when I come back from the hospital, I just need to chill out. I need to tend my garden a little bit that I can do at night. Mel can handle company however much he loves you. Please don't come. she was setting her boundaries. She was saying what she wanted and what she didn't want. And those of us who are friends of caregivers and, you know, and loved ones need to really honor that, that people need to be able to say no and to be able to say yes.
What are some things that we can do to support a caregiver in our community, in our circle of friends, in our family?
A couple of things. Ask the person what you can do for them today or this week, if anything. But don't say, let me know when you can use some help. That is worthless, okay? So if the person who was the caregiver, if you could approach them and talk about how can you identify 20 things that need to happen in the next month, small things that take a half hour or an hour, get them on a calendar, and let's rouse some people to sign up for those things.
One more parting thought. Here's how August reflects on caring for his father.
It gave me, and it can give you, some of the most meaningful experiences of intimacy and talking about things that matter. Okay, that's a really big thing. Okay, and when you look back at this time and you're able to say, yeah, you know, I had that. And also that I was able to walk my values. I really was able to show up. I was really able to do that.
Yosef August has written Coaching for Caregivers. Okay, I'm going to ask you to remember something. So pay attention. This is important. All information relating to the prescription of a controlled substance must be entered in the patient's medical record. The following information must be included: the name of the substance, its strength, the quantity, and the date it was prescribed. Okay, quick. What was the information that needs to be included? It's tough to remember, right? This was an excerpt from guidelines for physicians regulating the prescription of opioids. Two researchers at Penn wanted to see what would happen if they presented this kind of information a little differently. Laura Benchoff reports.
Here's a story about Frank.
Frank was a friendly middle-aged man, but Dr. Mitchell most remembered his mustache. Bushy and gray, it shook when Frank spoke about the pain in his back.
Frank is not a real person. He's a Trojan horse, if you will, carrying information. And Frank's story communicates guidelines from the American College of Emergency Physicians, guidelines intended to stop doctors from overprescribing painkillers.
Frank's story and exam did not raise flags for serious conditions, but he still seemed uncomfortable. Although Dr. Mitchell preferred non-opioid therapies, she chose to try one dose of Percocet and watch for any improvement. Frank's pain disappeared.
That's Austin Kalaru, a recent graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's medical school who worked on this research. The work tackles a big problem. Why don't doctors adopt the latest scientific guidelines?
There's lots of literature showing that doctors do a pretty terrible job when it comes to following guidelines. Our hypothesis was that, well, once we have information that we know is evidence-based, we could use stories as a way to make that information sticky and to get doctors to actually remember the evidence.
So Mizell and his team put some doctors to the test. Half got the story you heard and half got the plain old guidelines. After an hour, researchers asked them to share what they remembered.
The results were really astonishing. The level of recall for people who had just read the guideline itself was really quite low, almost to the point that we got quite a few responses where people were making up entirely new recommendations that had not been contained in the original guideline because they felt like they should have remembered something.
So stories one, guidelines zero. And there's science to back up the stickiness of stories. Princeton University professor Uri Hassan studies the neuroscience of storytelling.
And what we find over and over and over is that these stories are really powerful for the brain.
Hassan looks at what happens inside our brains when we hear a story, one that we can relate to. He finds that stories activate parts of the brain associated with memory, parts not activated by information that's easier to tune out.
These are very effective stimuli to induce memories in people.
Memory is one thing, but changing habits is another. So what Kalaru and Mizell want to study next is whether stories can affect doctors' behavior, like registering for their state's prescription drug monitoring program. Maybe they'll use Frank and his bushy mustache. For The Pulse, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Coming up on The Pulse, when it comes to selecting facial hairstyles, men could take a cue from guppies.
Female guppies will select males whose patterns are rare. And you can vary the patterns in the lab and have stripes versus dots. And like you make the dots rare and the females prefer the dots. You make the stripes rare and the females prefer the stripes.
Don't touch that razor. Stay tuned to The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Frog mating calls have been a passion for UCLA researcher Peter Nerens. He's especially smitten with one kind of frog.
This particular species, the Coqui frog, makes a two-note call. It's named Coqui because the first note is the co note, second note is the key note. It sounds something like that, Coqui. The first note is used by males to defend territories. And the key note, the second note, is used by males to attract females.
So first you tell the other guys to get out, and then you basically say, come here?
Exactly.
Let's hear, we have a clip of these frogs. Let's hear that.
Nerens first studied these frogs in 1983. He traveled up and down a mountain in Puerto Rico and measured the pitch of the frogs' mating calls as well as their size. It's an experiment he recently repeated. I asked him to first describe what he found back in the 1980s.
As we moved up the mountain, the frogs got larger and larger, and their calls, their two-note calls, became lower in pitch, so the first note and the second note, the co and the key notes, both dropped in pitch as we moved up the mountain. And furthermore, they called slower as we moved up the mountain. So if I may, the frogs at the bottom of the mountain sounded something like this, like you're recording. And at the top of the mountain, they were slower and lower pitched, so something like this. So the idea of the present study was to go back to Puerto Rico and repeat that same study that I just described. And we repeated the experiment as closely as possible. That is, we went along the same road. We stopped at 28 different altitudes. We measured the frogs' calls. We captured as many as we could, and we measured their length and put them back. Same idea.
And what did you find?
We found that in the 23-year period between the two experiments, that the frogs at one given altitude were calling at higher pitch and they called faster than they did 23 years earlier. In addition, the frogs were slightly smaller at the altitude, any altitude that we tried, compared to the earlier study. So the overall idea was that the frogs are resembling at any altitude those at the bottom of the mountain, that is, where the temperature was higher. So that was the idea. The motivation for the study to go repeat this 23 years later was to ask the question, is global warming, is temperature rise affecting the frog calls? And if so, how?
So what does this mean for the future of the Coqui frog?
Well, we make a prediction at the end of the paper, and I think it's conservative, but what we say is that if the trend of global warming continues as it has been over the past 23 years, because those are the data we looked at, then we think that at the end of the century, this century, the frogs will look and sound quite different than they do today. The frogs will become smaller, the pitch of the two notes will become higher, and they will call faster. And all of this has to do, of course, as I mentioned, the function of these two notes. One of the functions is to attract females. And we know that females' auditory system is tuned to the call pitch of the male. Now, if this tuning is tracking the male's call, then there probably won't be too much problem, okay? If the tuning in the female's ear doesn't match that of the change in the male's call, then there could be a mismatch. And this is the kind of thing that happens in experiments that we can do in the lab. And we know that the females choose in a laboratory males that are calling with a pitch that matches the temperature of their own ear. And so if this is disrupted in any way, then the future looks dim for these frogs for reproductive success.
Because then if the male calls, the female can't hear them.
Or hears them much less and is not as interested.
Hmm. And then they don't mate?
And then they don't mate. That's the idea. And the other possible problem is that because the animals are becoming smaller, that means that overall in Puerto Rico, just using these frogs, there's less biomass in the future. And the future then holds the problem that the predators on Coqui, they won't eat as much, and they will also be affected, as well as the animals that Coqui eats. So Coqui is part of the food web in Puerto Rico. It's an intimate part of the food web. And this can be disrupted if the biomass is reduced significantly, as it might be with increasing temperatures.
So basically, the hope is then, I guess, that the female's ears will adapt to the changed calls.
Absolutely. That's the hope.
So, in general, is our body of knowledge growing in terms of the effect on climate change on animals?
Oh, absolutely. We know that, for example, homeotherms, that is what we used to call warm-blooded animals, and those are the birds and the mammals, including ourselves, we spend a lot of energy, metabolic energy, trying to maintain a constant temperature in our body. If we have our temperature is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and if anything varies from, if it varies from that at any small amount, we say we have a fever, we don't feel well. It's very important to maintain constant temperature. Now, ectotherms, which we used to call cold-blooded animals, obtain their temperature from the environment. So they reptiles bask in the sun. Frogs will get out of the sun and go into a cave. So they'll move and they'll use behavior to change their body temperature. And as a result, this is why global climate change affects these ectotherms much more than it does endotherms. We have mechanisms to deal with changing temperature. They have behavioral mechanisms, but of course those behavioral mechanisms are not as flexible as ours. So this is one of the reasons that they tend to be kind of the canary in the coal mine for ecological temperature change.
Peter Nerens is a researcher at UCLA. Okay, we're going to stick with the general theme of mating for a moment, perhaps, or scratch that. Big beards have made a big comeback in recent years, and of course, men have no ulterior motives in picking their facial hairstyles, but just in case you're interested in what kind of facial hair scores points with the ladies, we got some science. Joining us now is our regular contributor, Dr. Bethany Brookshire, also known as SciCurious. She's a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public, and I asked her to describe this beard research for us.
So the question was actually a study on negative frequency-dependent selection. This is the idea that things become more attractive when they are rare. Previous studies on negative frequency dependent selection have actually been done in guppies, and they found that patterns in guppies, female guppies, will select males whose patterns are rare. And you can vary the patterns in the lab and have stripes versus dots, and like you make the dots rare and the females prefer the dots. You make the stripes rare and the females prefer the stripes. And so this is called negative frequency dependent selection, and we know that it takes place in guppies. But does it take place in humans? So to find this out, the scientists looked at facial hair growth in men. They conducted an internet study where they had over 1,400 women and over 200 men look at photos of a bunch of average-looking guys with different variations in facial hair. And they were able to show that in two conditions, the clean-shaven condition and the full beard condition, those two conditions became more attractive when they were rare in the population, but only more attractive. They did not become the most sexy. They just became more attractive. So you might say that the interpretations are subtly hairy.
So what was the most sexy selection then?
Generally, the highest attractiveness ratings went to heavy stubble.
Heavy stubble, all right. I mean, we know that from perfume ads, right?
Oh, of course.
So beard and clean shaven did well when it was the rare condition.
Yes.
It's not about the hair, it's about what's rare, really.
But the question is, why should we prefer what's rare? Especially if you can grow a beard, you can shave it. And, you know, there's infinite varieties. There's the mustache, there's the goatee, the Fu Manchu. You know, there's all sorts of facial hairstyles out there. These are not direct indicators of anything other than whether or not you can grow it. So it's a good question as to what is going on. And the authors hypothesize that it might not be a question of, as in guppies, with negative frequency dependent selection, guppies prefer rare because it means that they're probably mating with someone they haven't mated with before. In humans, you can't say that if a dude shaves his beard, you haven't mated with him before.
So we are more, are we more evolved than guppies then?
They think that in this case, it might be just novelty. You know, seeing something a little out of the ordinary makes it more attractive.
And is there a lot of research in this area of the selection process?
There's actually some really interesting research in orchids. And in orchids, they display negative frequency dependent selection because many orchids are pollinated by wasps. And they get pollinated by these wasps by pretending to look like a wasp. And then it's actually an orchid and he pollinates it by mistake. It works, but it only works if the orchid can fool the wasp. And the wasp gets smart to this. And so the orchids have to keep trying new things. And so they try rare things. And those rare things end up at negative frequency dependent selection. The wasps actually prefer the orchids that look more rare, more like different wasps.
Which is kind of what the guys do with the beards then, right?
Basically.
Thank you, Bethany.
Thank you.
That's regular Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab. At a lab at the University of Delaware, chemical engineer Richard Wool is utilizing everything from plants to chicken feathers to make things like tractors and sneakers. He sat down for our series, So What Do You Do?, where we pair a scientist with a layperson for down-to-earth conversations about science. Shoshana Martiniak, editor of The Jewish Voice, asked him,
So, what do you do?
I teach and I do research.
What does your research mostly focus on?
My research looks at green chemistry and engineering. So what we do in particular is we make a lot of materials and we design new materials and processes that are economically feasible while at the same time reducing the impact to the environment and people's health. It's our job to be able to look at molecules that nature provides and then be able to understand how we can use these molecules from renewable resources to give us the same set of properties.
You're also looking at not just the environment, but how it affects people's health?
Absolutely. Let's say we want to replace foam. Why do we want to do that? Because we know that the chemicals that are used to make foams, they're highly toxic. This is a major problem for foam manufacturers, actually.
What made you interested in this field?
It's something that I grew into over the years when I began a program in biodegradable plastics. We realized that with the shortages of petroleum, we should look to renewable resources, such as things that would grow in the field. At the time, there was a huge corn surplus, and the corn board had asked us to see if we could make all of our plastics out of cornstarch and the cellulose that comes with the corn cobs. So instead of working with petroleum-based materials, we're working with plants.
What kind of plants do you use?
We've been using soybean oil. We developed methodologies to build tractors. We built tractors for John Deere out of soybeans. We can build bridges out of this stuff. And so we've now commercialized that process. Fiberglass, hot tubs, boats, it can all be made using these kind of soybeans.
How about other things besides plants? What else do you use?
We use a lot of chicken feathers. Because we're in Delaware, the foremost agricultural products in Delaware are soybeans and chickens.
How do you get them?
There is actually a company that retrieves the feathers from the chicken processing plants. We have ways of treating the chicken feathers so they firm up and carbonize them when we heat treat them so they won't melt in plastic processing operations. And so we've made some very exciting electronic materials, circuit boards, using soybeans and chicken feathers.
Are you finding that younger scientists are interested in green chemistry?
Yeah, I would say that this is the probably one of the more popular courses at the University of Delaware. In fact, I could be teaching it morning, noon, and night and probably not run out of students.
How about people who go on? That they don't just take the class, then they want to sort of move forward with?
Yeah, the people who are trained in green chemistry and engineering never lose it. This issue of are we polluting? Are we generating systems that are not going to hurt the environment? Do we have a reduced carbon footprint? I, as the engineer, what can I do to improve it? These questions will be coming up for the rest of their lives.
University of Delaware chemical engineer Richard Wool speaking with Shoshana Martiniak, editor of The Jewish Voice. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Zewert, and Alana Gordon. Jeanette Woods produced segments for today's show. Laura Benchoff is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey, the chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, with your questions at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.